Sure.
This is the EWN Radio Network.
Hello, I'm Tara Darlington, and welcome to Empowering Motherhood Radio. So there's lots of different healing paths out there, and sometimes there's so many different ways to go. It's good to know a little bit more about in depth about what different people are doing and different courses and pathways that you can take. So my children, as most of you know who have been listening to the podcast, go to a Steiner school. And today we have Lisa Romeo, who is an health practitioner and adult educator in anthroposophy. Now, anthroposophy is something that is developed by Rudolf Steiner. We're going to learn a lot more about it talking to Lisa and the different workshops she does and how what she does with her education and healing pathway. So welcome to the show. And just start by telling us a little bit about yourself and how you got into the work that you do, Lisa.
Yeah, hi, Tara. How did I get into it? At the moment, let me tell you what the work I'm doing, and then maybe my biography makes a little bit of sense. Yeah. I am teaching inner development and meditation out of anthroposophy, and I've been doing that for the past sort of 12 years. I've written a couple of books. One is called Developing the Self, and it's through the inner work path in the light of anthroposophy. And the other book, The Inner Work Path, A Foundation of Meditative Practice in the Light of Anthroposophy. So my work now focuses primarily on inner development, and that's developing this sort of spiritual conscious aspect of the human being. And I've come to that over many years of investigation of meditative practice. In fact, I first started to learn about meditation at the age of 15. But in my 20s, I came to understand Rudolf Steiner's work, and that is the Western esoteric path to inner development, which has quite a different quality than the Eastern traditions. And then as a complementary health practitioner, I began to apply the understanding of anthroposophy to my practice and also to develop teaching about health and nutrition and male-female studies and various aspects of anthroposophy into the wider community. So I've been doing this for many years, probably more years than I haven't. And now I'm presenting various courses around the world. I talk mostly in New York, Canada, London, actually England, various places in England, and extensively in Australia each year. And the courses are varied. Some of the courses are really to do with the development of the child and how we work to parent a child in such a way that there is a healthiness between who that individual being is and the body, the vehicle that they're going to express themselves into the world through. So the meditative work or the inner development work that comes from anthroposophy supports parents to really hold that question, how do I help you be all that you need to be? And ultimately, as a parent, I think we all ask that question, how can I really help my child to be all that they need to be? So there are various courses, and they run throughout the year. You can easily see where they are and where I am at innerworkpath.com, and you can find out about what's being held in what part of Australia or America or the UK or Canada.
So that there is a real I find a lot of people are winging their parenting, and to actually stop and ask what it is that you're wanting and needing to develop in your child. Such a big question that actually a lot of people have been too busy to stop and ask. So, you know, they're doing what's normal, as in what everybody else seems to be doing, so that must be okay type of thing. And I know for myself, one of the main reasons I send my kids to a Steiner school, I didn't go to a Steiner school myself. I was at school, but half homeschooled. Mum preferred to keep us at home than send us to school. But I really wanted my children to stay in touch with who they were, and I wanted our lifestyle and our education to help develop them to be the best of themselves and bring out their qualities you know, as they grew up and hopefully not become disconnected to that. So a lot of the parenting exactly. practices that have become quite normal are really disconnecting children from who they are. And then you need your gap year to go and find yourself again, don't you, after you finish school. So talk a little bit about that, you know, about how you're working with that type of thing with children.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the things that in every one of my workshops I would present is how to begin to make decisions out of the most progressed aspect of yourself. Because we all know that within ourselves we have those voices that are sort of full of sort of wants and wishes and desires, those parts of us that kind of are more selfish and self-gratifying. And then we have that voice that's more of that reasoning, what we might call that intellectual reasoning mind, that kind of works things out and tries to understand everything and makes decisions from a point of view of being rational. But we also have this other voice, which we might call the discerning mind or the consciousness, that can actually recognize, I need to do this for my child, or I need to work in a particular way. And these aspects of our own inner life, sort of the three different qualities of which we can make decisions from, in a way it's good to get to know them, and it's also good to be able to school or develop what we might call our consciousness mind or our discerning mind, because in our times there is so much information out there that if you try to make a decision based on even research, you'll find there's contradictions. There's evidence and statistics to tell you how to parent in every different way. And there's so much knowledge out there that you kind of need an inner gauge to be able to steer yourself through, so you can parent your individual child how they need to be parented. So, yes, there are lots of schools of thought. There is so much information, many scientific studies, but even those studies contradict each other. And we see these studies right through in medicine, let alone education and child development, where it's something that is very hard to actually do such scientific research on. So what we're finding is that parents are becoming less connected to that sort of voice of inner wisdom in themselves, and finding that they are following what is being bombarded with. And according to their education, according to the circles that they move in, according to what they listen to, that's the information they get. But ultimately, we really want people to find, how would you find a connection to that inner knowing in yourself? That part of you that says, look, I know my child needs to go to this school. Not, well, I'm going to send them to this school because da-da-da, 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 and all the reasons why I might do it, but actually it goes against that sense of knowing this is what is truly right for my child.
We really have disconnected from our knowing, haven't we, and sort of undermined ourselves with it. That's what I do with the women that I work with. You know, there's the information, and then there's everyone's advice and counsel and stories, but then at the end you really have to stop and listen to yourself and go with your inner knowing, your gut feeling, whatever you want to call it, on which way you feel is right for you and that and your particular child at that time, or you and your family.
Yeah, and I think that's an interesting thing. You use those words, your inner knowing or your gut feeling, because in a way they're quite different things. And part of what Rudolf Steiner brings is that we've moved into what he calls the consciousness soul age. And that means that we now need to develop something. It's not that we've necessarily lost something, but we need to actually cultivate a quality of inner reliance that we may not have had in the past. And, of course, in our information age, we can even understand why he might have said that, because nowadays we rely on the opinion of others so much rather than that sense of where we know we need to be or what we know we need to do out of that inner voice. Now, I wouldn't necessarily call it that gut feeling, because the gut feeling is that part that often, you know, desires something, has a passion for something, and as wonderful as that is, can sometimes draw us into things that we have a sympathy for, or we avoid things because we have a dislike for it. But it's not really based on that quality voice in us that recognizes, I know I need to do this.
I'll
give you
an
example. I was asked to teach in Japan. I was asked to teach in Japan several years ago, and it was an interesting experience for me, because from a reasoning point of view, it wasn't a useful thing to do. You know, I was getting less money than I would get if I stayed at home. It wasn't improving anything on my CV. There was no kind of irrational reason to go to Japan to teach. From a sort of desire point of view, I didn't really feel like, well, that's what I want to do, leave my daughter, go to a different culture, immerse myself there. I don't really like travel. I like travel, but I don't really like aeroplanes. There wasn't a sort of desire to do it. But there was this kind of what I'd call an iron rod of knowing, this is my task. I know I need to do this. And in following that, I, you know, unfolded things in Japan that I couldn't possibly have done without going there. And I had such appreciation of what developed because I followed what I knew I needed to do. It was also something that became very powerful in my daughter's life. She came with me on several occasions, and it has affected, in a way, something in her own development. If I'd followed my gut instinct, which said, no, don't do it, or if I followed my rational mind that said, oh, well, it's, you know, it's not really valuable as a career move, I wouldn't have got there. But I knew that there was something more in it. And that is what we try to work with in the inner work path, is developing what we call these inner capacities, so that you can become the guide of your own life. And in fact, in anthroposophy, that's one of the key things that stands against, or stands it separate from many other traditions. It says that you don't look to a guru, you don't look to something outside of yourself, but your own inner voice is your one and true only guide. It's just about us developing a clear and conscious relationship to that.
Which is where meditation, practicing meditative practices come in, isn't it? We actually need to practice doing that. So we're going to take a short break, and I want to come back and talk more about developing that quality.
Right. This is the EWN Radio Network.
Lisa Romero talking about many things about our inner pathway, and we were just talking about the, you know, we need to practice meditation. It's a practice. It's something that if we don't do, we almost need to relearn how to do it. And I think meditation and yoga, for example, are becoming so popular in the West because we're really falling over without it in a lot of ways. So talk to us about that quality of meditation and about the need to practice it.
Yeah, so when working out of anthroposophy, we're working with a Western esoteric schooling of meditation and meditative exercises. And that focus is actually being able to not only feel a connection to that inner knowing, but also begin to train and even transform some of the aspects of self that would pull us away from that inner knowing. So generally, when we're working, for instance, in my book, Developing the Self, I give about 20 or so different exercises that help us to take our own inner life in an inner schooling. We want to school the forces that we have in us, not simply just find a place of rest. Of course, restfulness is a wonderful way to sort of feel like you've come back to a connection with yourself. But what? How does that develop our capacity to really recognize what we need to do and when we need to do it? That comes out of a sort of deeper wisdom or a deeper guidance that we in the Western schooling work through a training rather than, for instance, just resting our bodies or focusing on the breath or doing something which allows us to be aware of ourselves but isn't really cultivating an inner schooling or an advancement of our inner life. So many of the Eastern practices, say the mindfulness practices, they begin in a youthful place, being aware of the self, being aware of the chatter in the mind, being aware of the body. But in the Western schooling, there's also a need. We're in the world. We're in this world where there is an evolving of consciousness. How would we support the evolution of consciousness in ourselves, which actually affects the evolution of consciousness in the world around? So there is this idea in anthroposophy that we can work out of the less developed aspects of our being, or we can also strive to work out of the most progressive or the most heightened awareness in ourselves, and not only strive to work out of that, but develop a stronger and stronger relationship to it. So it is via exercises, it is via observing oneself, and through meditative practice, but it's not a practice of the traditional type of I'm just going to be mindful and watch what's going on or just watch my breath, which of course helps us to take ourselves out of the clamour of life but doesn't necessarily build this inner strength that helps us to meet life in a new way and in fact meet the challenges of this ever-changing world.
I think a lot of people are only scratching the surface. So, you know, in yoga, pratyahara is just withdrawing the senses and starting to, you know, observe oneself. And it really is the first step. And I find it interesting the discussion that happens at the moment around mindfulness. You know, mindfulness is more of, sometimes I think it's more of the outcome than the practice, you know. And we do need exercises and guidance to come to these things. So give us an example of the type of exercises that you work, you know, that you teach people or work with people.
Yeah. Well, there are so many exercises, but one of the exercises that would be easy for someone to look at would be something like a very simple inner schooling exercise, where you try to observe how many judgments that you make in the day. So you watch your judging self. And it's quite amazing how the human being is wanting freedom and yet how unfree we are. So, for instance, you might meet somebody that you immediately have an experience of dislike for. And you don't necessarily know why you have a dislike, but we make all these associations from our past. And Rudolf Steiner gave this example that perhaps this person is wearing the exact same colour as your mean headmistress used to wear. You have no recognition of that past association, but you immediately have a dislike. So our inner life doesn't work out of the present unless we bring presence to it. And when we bring presence to it, we can start to begin to see, gosh, just how much goes on in me that isn't actually free, that's coming from associations of my past or coming from conditions, but actually isn't allowing me to be free and present right near now in this moment that I meet this individual person. So certain exercises like observing your judgments, and you do so throughout the day, you become aware of how unfree you are, in fact. And then, of course, there are other exercises that you do so in a meditative practice. And that practice is about taking the part of your soul life, your inner life, that would usually be focused on associations and being drawn into the outer world through the sense experiences, instead of letting your inner life being ruled by the outer experiences that you're having, you actually school it by focusing in it directly on a image or a verse that allows your inner life to actually take in other images than the ones that are usually being called from the outer world. And one of those images comes out of the Rosicrucian school, which is called the Rose Cross Meditation. And by developing a not just I'm focusing on my breath, just being mindful, but I'm actually going to make my mind, make my inner life focus on trying to create a particular image, and that image has a definite symbol about it, about the transformation of the human being. If I focus my mind on that and understand the path of transformation and evolution that the human being is going through, I don't just let my inner life do what it wants, but I actually train it towards developing certain capacities. So as I said, there's many exercises, and that really depends on where the individual is in themselves, where they would begin. I usually suggest people start with the book Developing the Self, because they are the exercises you do every day. They're sort of the ones that you would do to observe who you are and what's affecting you and what's making you unfree. If someone's ready for a deeper meditative path, then the Inner Work Path book will give you the foundations of meditation out of this, and out of Anthroposophy, which is a Western approach to developing one's inner world. And what that does for the human being is it means that we become stronger in life, not hypersensitive, and we feel like we have to sort of run off to a monastery to sort of take care of ourselves, but rather much stronger, and we can affect then the decisions that we're making, how we are around our children, what we feel and recognize to be the conditions of which we want to bring them up in. And that all comes from developing those qualities within oneself. Of course, you can hear about them, and you can hear about what other people say to do, and you can try to implement them. But ultimately, when they come from your own inner experience and your own inner clarity, then they have a far greater effect on the whole atmosphere of the child's world than if you're trying to apply a technique or something that you've heard would be good for child development.
Yes, and that's where the creativity comes in, allowing our creative self to flow and to draw it from ourselves and from our children. And from what you were saying before, I mean, you know, a lot of people are familiar with affirmations, so and mantras, it's becoming a more popular known word as well. So an affirmation would be a very basic level of what you're talking about, where you're breathing in, or you're working with creating a picture of yourself on a deeper level in a certain way, rather than just observing. And the other thing I want to point out is, you know, the morning verse that the children say at a Steiner school, that comes to mind as well when you're talking about this stuff, which, my 16-year-old was rattling off all her morning verses from class one up the other day, which was, they're really living in her. So that really comes to mind as well with what you're saying.
Yeah, you're breaking up slightly, but I'll respond to it anyway. The affirmations are a little bit different in a way, because affirmations often are formed out of what do I want. Whereas when we work with a mantra, or we work with something that comes out of the esoteric schooling, we try to work with a truth that goes beyond any personal desire whatsoever. So when you create an affirmation, inevitably an affirmation has something to do with what you want, the sort of outcome you would like, or something that you would like to see or experience. Whereas when we're working with thoughts that are belonging to a higher truth, they are really schooling our relationship to wisdom rather than our relationship to our own preferences or our own wants. Even if those wants and preferences are high ideals, nevertheless, life is such that it gives you what you need often, not necessarily what you want. Of course, we can work with that with affirmations, placing out into the world what we want. But beyond what we want, there is a mystery that says life is trying to wake us up. And in the waking up, we know that we're evolving. We're evolving our consciousness, we're evolving our love, and we're evolving our responsibility. And that doesn't have to sound New Age in any sense of the word. Every human being really could say, I want to become a conscious, loving, responsible human being, and to grow in that. And life is a path of evolving those things. So in the inner schooling, we're trying to work with how would we support the most evolving development in ourselves and in our children, rather than how would I create a life that suits me or gratifies me, rather how would I help this evolution? Because consciousness, love and responsibility don't always develop on the easy or happy path. They develop out of our real ability to work with what life gives us and to transform the struggles into something extraordinary.
Which is about, you know, following the flow of life instead of working against it all the time as well. You know, we've lost that capacity in a lot of ways too. You know, as you were saying with, you know, you can look at affirmations as, you know, I want to be like this, I want to get here. You sort of might be working toward the goal rather than supporting yourself to, you know, flow with what life gives you and you know, trusting that that's taking you on the evolutionary path that you're meant to be on. So do you think that with this work there's a bit more of allowing yourself to follow the flow of your life rather than, you know, trying to make your life all the time?
Yeah, well, it would be, I mean, it would be wonderful if the human being could say, you know, as I want the strength and the wisdom to meet what needs to come to me, rather than I want life a particular way. And that is really allowing us to kind of flow with life, as you put it, but also allow the unexpected, because having children, as anyone knows, means that you have to be prepared for growth and development, because you cannot stay the same and be a parent. Something is transformed through the nature of trying to be conscious, loving and responsible for another human being. And that's the other thing that happens out of the anthroposophical path. Rudolf Steiner is very clear that we're not working on a path of inner development so that we ourselves can get the hell out of Dodge and get off the wheels of life and death, as it's often given in many of the Eastern paths. But we're working on a path of development because we want to see a world where there is this evolution, consciousness, love and responsibility of all humanity. Not I'm just trying to do it so I don't have to get affected by the world around me, but rather we want the world to grow. And of course every parent has a different relationship, because the moment you have children you recognize for the love of the other we want to improve. We want to deal with our anger issues. We want to deal with our anxiety. We want to deal with our fear, because we don't want that on our children. And so the inner development will help us to change our inner life, and therefore it's not an environment that the children grow up in. That's one aspect of it. The other aspect, of course, is that it allows us to have that connection to that wisdom, which can really guide our children. And after all, our children aren't looking for us to be their best buddies. They're looking for us to really help their growth and development until they can take on the growth and development in themselves. And ultimately, that's the premise or the reason behind Waldorf Education. The idea behind Steiner schools and Waldorf Education is that we help the child come into the world in such a way that as adults they will have all that they need to take their development and evolve forward, and that we don't want to hinder them by burdening them through childhood with things that actually will mean that they are disconnected, as you say, or blocked from their own development and connection later in life. And Steiner Schools and Ward of Education has really stands behind that we want to support that child so as an adult they can take the world further. It's not about individuals getting the best for themselves, but it's about individuals working for the best of the all.
Mm. Yeah, that's beautiful. It's you can see on Facebook and online that there is a growing consciousness around this with, you know, the growing number of posts about this type of thing. A beautiful thing came up this week and it had a long table of people sitting at the table and it said, if you have plenty, build a longer table, not a higher wall. and that was really, really beautiful of what you're talking about, of really developing our consciousness for the all and not just for the individual. I want to take another quick break. Yeah. I want to talk more about all of your workshops a little bit later, but you work with around health and well-being, which is one of the topics that has come up. So we'll be back to that
you're
in a moment.
You're connected to the EWN Radio Network.
Lisa Romero talking about creating a deeper connection with our evolving self and our parenting and how that's going to, you know, how we need to, we're on an evolution ourselves as a parent. There's a lot of changes that happen and really connecting with that. And I want to talk now, Lisa, about your work with health. Tell us about what you do there.
Yeah, well, interestingly, they're not so separated. Give you this example.
Yeah.
So it's been said that in the 13th century, they said that illness came from God. In the 15th century, they said illness came from the devil. In the 17th century, they talked about humours, and that's why there was blood let in, and this idea that the fluids were out of balance in the body. In the 19th century, they say it's microbes, you know, there's a problem of what's attacking us. In the 21st century, it's interesting because now they're looking at health and illness as connected still to this microbic picture, but actually where someone else is susceptible to that. So if your gut's not doing well, then you're susceptible to particular illnesses. And of course, then the susceptibility around genetics. So the idea of health or illness has evolved over the times in the external world of science. But in the inner development world, in the world of meditation, in the world of evolving consciousness, the idea of health and illness has always come from the same place. And that is, we become unwell because it is also a part of our development. How do we work with health and illness that allows us to recognize this evolution of the human being? And what I mean by that is something as simple as a fever. We often see children with a fever, and in our times now we see let's stop that fever immediately. We don't want them to experience discomfort. We don't want them to experience these symptoms. However, we also know, and a lot of the old school doctors will tell you this, that when a child goes through a fever and a difficult struggle with illness, they often come out the other side of it having grown a few inches, being able to now ride that two-wheeler bike that they couldn't ride before unless they had the training wheels, being able to socialise a bit better, even being a little bit more sharp in their thinking. So the idea that illness is there to take you down and must be stopped at all costs has a very different picture than in the world of inner development, where we say, how would we make sure that fever does not, of course, create an imbalance that would harm the human being, but actually look at what it is trying to help? How would it serve the individual to experience a mild fever, which allows them at the end of it to just maybe stand a little bit more taller in themselves in different ways? And that's where this interesting connection comes. Health and nutrition is not just about the body. Health and nutrition actually has a lot to do with our evolving self as well. And we can say that about the world. I mean,
yeah, I'd love to give an example before we move on, which my three-year-old, sure. the half-year-old, last week, she had a bit of a temperature. She vomited once. She was fine the next morning. She got a temperature. She vomited again the next day. Again, she was fine the next day. So it wasn't, I was like, okay, it's not a tummy bug because it's, you know, she would just keep vomiting. She did that 3 days. And then the next day she sat up and did a painting. And before this, her paintings were, you know, very shapes and that weren't formed. You couldn't see a tree or a flower or anything in her paintings. And the next day she did a painting that was perfect trees with the brown trunks and the greeny blue, very Australian gum tree tree leaf, and a yellow streak across the sky and a green streak across the bottom and a blue streak through the middle of the sky. And I actually posted on Facebook, like, oh, my God, look what my child's done. That's why she was vomiting. And now she has totally evolved to this next step. And a lot of people, when you do say that, are like, you know, what are you talking about? But what you're talking about is exactly what I was talking about, is it not?
Yeah, that's right. We could see that some illnesses, not all, of course, but some illnesses are there really supporting development. And we see that as a part of growing up. And also, some illnesses are really there to show us that we're not living correctly. Now, they say that one in three adults in the UK now have allergies. We can't be living correctly. That's a huge statistical change. It's a 500% growth over the past 20 to 30 years. There is something wrong when there's a 500% growth in the antidepressants that are being handed out. So when we look at illness processes and epidemics that are facing us, not necessarily a microbe epidemic, but something like the allergy epidemic, we must say, is it trying to wake us up to something? We will have to take a different approach to life if we want to stay well. So from that point of view, I'm not trying to be too alternative, but to say, how do we think about these things in terms of the evolution of the human being? And some of the decisions we make as a collective humanity are now being reviewed. We know that although antibiotics may have been a breakthrough, they also are causing a little bit of a breakdown. So we have to review how we meet these things. And that means that even the illness process in the world of science is helping us to evolve as a humanity. So surely it would also help us to evolve as individual beings. If we find that we are constantly allergic to something, it might not just be the food that's at fault, but why is it that I can't overcome that particular food substance? What is it that the human being is so inundated with that it finds it hard to just metabolize naturally now?
And these questions, it's a good question. Of course, I love the question. We're not living, you know, what are we not, you know, we're not living right. What is it that we're not, you know, we need to change in our living to, you know, to change our health? It's a lovely way to put it. That's actually quite simple. And I think most people could relate to that. You know, it's the thing of, it's not what's wrong with the child, but what's wrong for the child. You know, what's going on in a child's life that they're sick all the time or they're behaving quote unquote badly. You know, they can't sit still. So, you know, what's wrong in our life? You know, how are we living that we need to change? It's a lovely way to put it.
Well, simple things like we know that if they've been watching technology a lot during the day, it takes them longer at night to go to sleep when they don't sleep so deeply and they're not rested as well. Their life, the growth forces, they struggle with their energy the next day. They're more susceptible to things coming in because the immune system is lower through the lack of sleep and so forth. They all kind of make sense, but it's very hard mm-hmm. for us to adjust our world to say, well, let's not let them have those things that are going to stop them from sleeping deeply, because it's become such a part of our world. It's such a part of our world to be engaged in all forms of technology, whether it be television or screens or phones or...
Yes.
But is
being
it,
entertained and occupied.
Is it helping their health? That's right.
Yeah, that's right. That's yeah, right. I have...
and the digestion...
Continue, yeah, the digestion.
Go ahead.
Okay,
well,
just
the digestion
that with
process
my kids,
of the child...
Yeah. Mm.
we have a slight delay. The digestive process for the child, you know, to be able to sort of lay and just think about nothing or the tree or the sky or, you know, just to let themselves be in a digestive process in their own inner world instead of constantly being entertained and being filled up with something. So if you imagine that we have to digest everything we take into ourselves, it's not just the food, we also have to digest in a way the air, the environment, but we also have to digest all the stimulation, all the sense impressions. So what comes through the sensory system also has to be metabolized. And of course, so much is coming in through the sensory system that our digestions are overloaded, and so then we find it difficult to just digest simple foods because we have no digestive capacity left. And then on top of that, the great digestion of sleep is being weakened, and we're seeing insomnia in so many adults and children that are just not getting enough sleep to allow themselves to sort of be robust the next day.
Yeah, that's very common. I can't remember the statistics, but there are statistics out there of how much less sleep children get now to 20, 30, 40 years ago,
yeah.
Aren't there? I can't remember what they are. So we're going to have another quick break, and I want to talk about your work with working with sexuality and gender from classes 5 to 12, because there is, you know, real confusion, I think, about how we, you know, should we be treating our boys and girls differently? Do they have different needs? You know, I think there's, are we, you know, do our boys need to be tougher? Do they need to be kinder? There's like so many questions there. So I'm really interested to hear what you are doing with your work there. So we'll be back in a moment to talk about that.
This is the EWN Radio Network.
So I've been talking with Lisa Romero about all sorts of work with our inner work and developing our inner selves and our connection to that, and for our children as well. So a big part of that is obviously sexuality and gender. And as I was just saying, I think a lot of people have a lot of questions about this topic. So tell us about your work with this.
Yeah, so again, this arises out of working through the idea that the human being is evolving. And when we're evolving our consciousness, it means that there is a change in relationship to things from how we did them in the past. Now, of course, that sounds so obvious when you look at the world today and we consider how we are changing ideas around sexuality and gender and stereotypes and the fact that there are laws against sexism, there are gender discrimination laws, there are race discrimination laws, there are all these laws that say it's time for us to change the way that we see and think about things. And I do write about this in my book, Developing the Self, where the evolving consciousness actually has placed us in a in a realm where we're not all able to sort of catch up to that. And what I mean by that is this age of consciousness soul means that what is the most significant part of the human being is their individual self. That means the quality of the individuality has to become the very thing that we assess a human being as. Now, Martin Luther King was a definite consciousness soul man when he says, you do not judge a man by the color of his skin, but by his inner characteristics. Rudolf Steiner gave this himself many times. He says, you cannot assess a human being by their outer self, but by their ability to deepen life inwardly. Who are you as an individual being? So from a point of view of anthroposophy, the body that we enter into, we could say the vehicle of which we are going to express in life in one way or another, is not our individual self, but in fact is the vehicle. Just as the musician is playing the instrument and we don't put the guitar up on stage and everybody claps the guitar, we clap the musician. How did you play that guitar? So when it comes to gender work, it's very important that we help young people distinguish between bodily processes, what goes on in my biology, and that, of course, bodily processes actually has a different capacity or expression in the male body than it does the female body. We just have to look at the two classic pictures. The ovum is the largest cell of the human body. The sperm is the smallest cell of the human body. And she has this one egg coming each month where he has 200 million sperm per ejaculation. There's a vast difference in that comparison of the instrument. And we can recognize that in that, the child that's developing with a particular body needs to learn how to care and manage for the instrument in a way that's the most healthy. Gender, on the other hand, as you'll see from all the latest research, they're recognizing how gender is socialized. And gender primarily, of course there are aspects where it's not, but primarily comes from how an individual is treated. So the recent neuroscience is showing us that if you treat a girl in a particular way, she will experience neural pathways that are formed, which means her experiences later on in life are different than if you're treated in a different way as a boy. So according to how you're treated and how you're developed, you will have certain processes more available to you. So it's very important that we recognize that we are schooling certain things into the child unconsciously just by the way we pick them up. Where we pick up a girl or a boy the same way, do we meet them as individuals, or are we meeting them because of the vehicle that they carry? Are we meeting them and treating them according to their instrument rather than according to who they really are as individuals? What are the capacities of this? And you would know this more than most, because when you have six children, you know they bring something with them. They've come to the same family, they're sort of living in the same environment, but they have these qualities. And it is that, and Steiner says this is the first, and the first prerequisite of a Waldorf teacher is to have reverence for the soul spiritual potential that the child is bringing with them. And it's very important that we have reverence for that aspect of who the human being is. Now, the difficulty with gender and work on boys and girls is it crosses that line. On one hand, we're trying to say, how can we help you be all that you need to be? But on the other hand, we know that we've got to make some big changes on how we're dealing with this. We can see the big changes in the world, but we don't know what to do. So what we often do is look back to ancient traditions. Well, what did they do? What did they do in the past? Well, we had women's circles and men's circles, or we had groups where, you know, and this is happening, unfortunately, I think, in schools where girls have to sit around and talk about menstruating, where the boys go out and, you know, build fireplaces or go camping. And a lot of the young people today are saying, I'm not interested in that. They are coming in quite differently. They are saying, you know, my best friend is a boy. Just because he's got different reproductive organs doesn't mean to say I can't be such close friends with him. But two generations ago, that was a little bit unheard of, because you know, we're changing, we're evolving. So it is actually really important from a point of view as a parent or an educator that we really try to identify who is the musician and what is the instrument, rather than actually linking that individual to their body is the most important thing about them. So there, for instance, these rites of passage which celebrate a girl going into womanhood. Now, one thing is we all know that we were never a woman just because we menstruated. That's actually a really old cultural process. It doesn't belong to our times to think you're a woman because you can menstruate. And so what we're doing is identifying this strong importance to being able to menstruate. Well, I have many friends that have not had children and that won't have children. We're moving to an age where your bodily processes aren't going to identify you as who you are. It's what are your capacities that identify who you are. You shouldn't be given a job in the world or a task in the world based on your reproductive organs. It should be based on what capacities do you have as an individual being. And although people mean well when they prophesize these pictures around boys and girls and dividing them, they actually are amplifying a imbalanced future and a division in the sexes. So as the future goes on, we are going to see, we will have to see, that this will become a different process. And we can, you know, it's very important because the more we focus on the body, the more we end up over-sexualizing young girls rather than actually saying, who are you as an individual? I'm not interested so much on how you look and your reproductive organs. I'm interested on you as an individual being. So, of course, we need to understand the biological differences that they have to contend with. It's very different for a young 13-year-old boy to understand his body than it is for a 13-year-old girl. But at the end of the day, that is not who they are. Who they are is this individual being that has something to grow into the world with, something to give the world, but also to keep developing in themselves. And we should be focusing on that rather than on their gender. We have got so much research that tells us what the brain is very minimally different in men and women, but the overall research tells us what you believe has the greatest effect. So, for instance, if you give a whole group of boys a math paper and you tell them this math paper was designed for the female, they will do worse at it. If you tell them in Australia this math paper was designed for the Asian brain, they will do worse at it. But if you tell them that it was designed just for them, they will do better. So we have to be really cautious as we work with this idea of gender, that we recognise there are aspects of the human being that have differences, but how much do we want to amplify those differences when it comes to the evolution of your individual child? We want to say, who are you as an individual? How can I support you be all that you need to be? Not how can I work with you in such a way that you're destined to only live particular aspects of your life out according to the conditioning that I'm going to present to you through our culture, through our society.
Yeah, it's interesting because I do get a lot of people saying, oh, do you find the girls like this and the boys like that? And my answer is always, oh, it's their personalities. It's each child, you know, has their way of dealing with things, of doing things and of their interests. So, yeah, with six children, I definitely see that, you know, it's not a gender thing. It's something that's coming from deep within themselves, their sort of imprint.
And we can serve them so much if we continue to keep having reverence and recognition of that. And we, in a way, play down this idea that if you're a girl, you can, if you're a boy, you can, because it's really on the move. You know, recently, whilst working with some young children, for the first time ever, I heard a young boy say, when we were talking about what they wanted to do with their lives, say, I would like to be a father and parent my children. That's what I really want to do. You know, and it's actually an option now. It's also an option for a woman to say, I don't wish to have children, or I'm going to be in a relationship where I choose to do it differently. We need to allow individual freedom to preside over gender. And this is where, you know, we have laws to say on one level, but on another level, it's very hard for us to be aware of how deeply it resides in us. Like I often say to people that I'm working with, we do it around other things. We do it around race. We do it around religion. We do it around gender. We do it around social standing or social rank. So, for instance, when you go to visit a doctor, do you give the same level of presence to the receptionist as you do the doctor? Do you kind of front up with the same level of interest and presence in yourself? Or, because of social standing, do you give the doctor much more interest and presence? Or do you give them much more interest and presence because you're just more interested in yourself? It's an interesting question. And it's the same with gender. Like when you're meeting with someone of a different gender, do you give them the same self? Do you stand with the same consciousness? Or are you altering yourself in order to sort of play a game that you don't even realize what we're playing? Because the social constructs are so deeply inwoven in us that we often don't recognize that we're even doing them. I'll give you an example, if you don't mind. I have a client once that said, this client said, I really want to deal with my abandonment issues. Because, you see, those issues we're often aware of. So I said, can you tell me about them? She said, yeah, well, my first husband was, you know, he betrayed me. And then my second husband, he calls me every day because he knows I have a bit of a thing about that, because my first husband went off with his secretary. So he calls me every day and he checks in with me. And he called me at 12 o'clock. And then we put the phone down, and then this black fella came to my back door, and I shouted to him, get off my property. And I immediately called my husband back because he would want to know that, and he wasn't at the office. And I got freaked out, and I didn't know what to do, and you know, by the time he got home from work, I was beside myself. Anyway, there was nothing wrong at all. It was simply my stuff come up. He was at the other office. I'd got all the pictures mixed up in myself. And, of course, what she's aware of is her abandonment issue, something that's come out of her biography that she's aware of. She's not aware of her prejudices to what she calls black fellas. She didn't even think to say to me, I need to come and see you about this prejudice that lives in me. When someone of a different coloured skin comes to my door, I scream at them.
Yes.
Because that's how deep conditioning goes. We don't know it, we're just living it. And it's not until someone wakes us up and says, we've got to do it differently, do we realize that lives in me. And of course, we all have those things. They live below the threshold of consciousness. And gender lives there. We don't realize how conditioned we are about gender until we face it and start to say to ourselves, how do I really treat my children? Do I really look to them as individuals? Or am I saying to the girls, like a teacher unconsciously says to the class, okay, I need all the boys to move the tables, and the girls, can you go and get flowers because we want to make the room pretty? Now, you would really kick yourself. If you really think about what you're saying, you would kick yourself, because it should be, in our times, can the people that want to move tables, move tables? Can the people that want to get the flowers, get the flowers? How can we limit a human being to a way prescribed from generations ago? So my work around gender is not about saying there are no differences in the human being and what they have to work with, but actually saying, what's the most important thing? How do we keep a language going that helps the individual child recognize the most significant thing about you is who you are? Because that is what helps them in teenage years. That's what helps them get through all of those struggles that are going to come from society and get stronger about all these conditions of how they should look, who they should be, all of these things. If you focus their whole life on you, who you are is most important to me, not the way you look, not your reproductive system, not all of those things that otherwise I unconsciously treat you by, but who are you as an individual? How can I support that to grow in you? And how can I keep my eye on that? Because when it comes down to it, that's the thing that's going to give them the inner strength.
That's right. And so we need to, as parents, we really need to do that work for ourselves. That's where we need to start, isn't it? So as we do more work on ourselves, then we will work, you know, on a deeper level with the children and connect with the children on that level. But we need to do that work on ourselves first.
Well, yes, there's an esoteric saying that says, if you wish to see the light of the spirit without, you must first awaken the spirit within. So if you want to see the capacities of your children, can you recognise the capacities that you carry? You need to sort of be able to know something about who you are. Not that I am a woman, that I am a mother, that I am a sister, that I am a wife, that I am any of those things, but what is really something that is me? What is the I consciousness in me? And what have I got to bring the world? And everyone has something to bring. There's not a human being alive that hasn't got something to bring. From the spiritual understanding of the human being, we wouldn't be on earth if we haven't got something to give, even though we're here awakening and evolving at the same time.
Well, that's a beautiful way to end this interview, I have to say. It's so true. I want to thank you so much for your time and talking about your work. And even just, I'm sure, you know, a lot of people listening would have recognised some things in themselves and, you know, just from listening to this conversation. So thank you so much for joining us. You can visit the Romero's website, theinnerworkpath.com. In there you can see, find her publications, her books, and also her courses, workshops and retreats coming up. There's a calendar there, and she's not just in Australia, so you can watch out for when she's coming to see you.
Yeah, it's actually innerworkpath.com.
Innerworkpath.
I don't know if it'll probably get you there anyway.
Oh, sorry. Okay, I said the wrong thing.
Thank you for your time.
Yeah, it's
no,
a pleasure,
fine.
And I look
thank
forward
you for
to
time.
Seeing you. Yeah, look forward to seeing you up at school next
yeah.
year. Or is it this year or next year you'll be
yeah,
at
Yeah, I'll be there. I'll be
yeah,
there next
excellent.
Year. I booked my calendar, unfortunately, a year ahead, so it won't be till next year, but I do look forward to seeing you there. And
yeah,
I hope
I'll definitely go well with this.
I hope your listeners go well with this wonderful task of parenting.
Yeah, that's right. Well, they're listening to interviews like yours, so they'll definitely be on a path of doing, you know, feeling better about what they're doing and feeling supported about what they're doing and feeling a bit more knowledgeable. So that's awesome. And I'll see you at our school next
Great.
Year. I look forward to that. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
This is the EWN Radio Network.